It's Wednesday, August 7th. It's Minnesota's News on Your Schedule, the NPR News Update. I'm Phil Picardi. Coming up, Governor Dayton wants to unshackle schools. Candidates are beginning to line up for what was once considered a fairly dull elective office. Farmers at Farm Fest are a little less than festive with the elected officials. Love and Rockets in the comics. And will you miss the Metrodome? First, utility crews work to restore power to thousands of customers who lost service when damaging winds and hail moved through Minnesota last night. Xcel Energy says more than 40,000 customers lost power at one point. Minneapolis police fanned out across the city last night visiting national night out block parties. Matt Sepik reports.
Even as storms threatened, Chief Janae Harto and 180 of her officers hit the streets to try to stop at all 1,450 neighborhood gatherings. The effort follows several recent racially charged incidents, including two bar fights involving off-duty officers. 18-year-old Emmanuel Aquino was at a block party in North Minneapolis and says the cops have never caused him trouble.
If you're going to hit them, they're going to hit you back. That's how it is. Like, they're nice people. They're here to help us.
Harto says she won't tolerate racism in her department. The incidents are under investigation. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
Police say they have completed the active investigation into the murder of a Cold Spring police officer last November. Conrad Wilson has more.
Police say a man named Eric Thomas would have been arrested for the murder of Officer Tom Decker outside a Cold Spring bar. But Thomas took his own life in January when investigators sought to interview him. They now say Ryan Larson, the man initially arrested but released, is no longer a suspect.
The damage has already been done. I mean, investigators brought me in the night of the murder. They talked to me until 5 or 6 in the morning, threw me in a cell, and never once talked to me again. So I think it was pretty clear to them very early on in the investigation that I had nothing to do with it.
Though the case is no longer active, it's not officially closed, and officials say any leads from the public would be pursued. Conrad Wilson, Minnesota Public Radio News, St. Cloud.
Another Southern Minnesota Republican has stepped forward in hopes of challenging DFL Congressman Tim Walz in the 1st Congressional District next year. Here's our Mark Zedeklik.
44-year-old Aaron Miller has never before run for elective office. He lives outside of Rochester in Byron and works for a biotechnology firm. The Army veteran says if he's elected to replace Democrat Tim Walz in Congress, he will work to cut spending in Washington and otherwise reduce the scope of the federal government.
We're past passing our debt onto our children. We're passing it onto their children into theirs. And the government spending needs to be reined in.
Last month, Republican State Representative Mike Benson of Rochester announced his campaign for the 1st District congressional seat. Benson is not pledging to abide by the GOP endorsement. Miller is, meaning he's ruled out a primary campaign if he fails to win the endorsement. Mark Zedeklik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
DFL State Representative Steve Simon is running for Minnesota Secretary of State. The St. Louis Park Democrat is the third member of his party to say he's running to replace Mark Ritchie, who said in June he won't seek re-election. As Tom Scheck reports, the normally staid race for Secretary of State could be hotly contested in 2014.
Steve Simon says Secretary of State is a natural office for him to seek. He's the chair of the House Elections Committee and has been working on voter issues since he was first elected to the Minnesota House in 2004.
I'm running because I think it's a good fit. It's something that I've been passionate about and involved in for a very long time.
Simon said his record of working with Republicans in the legislature is one reason why voters should choose him. For example, he authored an elections bill last session that allows people to vote absentee without an excuse.
From now on, people who wish to vote absentee no longer have to sign the blood oath that they are going to be out of town that day. Rather, they can vote absentee for any reason or no reason at all, which people of all walks of life, all political persuasions, have been doing for a long time anyway, but this just brings it out into the open.
Simon has been considering a run since Democrat Mark Ritchie announced in June that he would not seek a third term. Simon's decision to enter the race means he'll be competing for the DFL endorsement against two fellow Democrats he worked with in the Minnesota House, Representative Deb Hillstrom of Brooklyn Center and former Representative Jeremy Kalin. All three said they'll drop out if they don't win the party's endorsement. Hillstrom has worked to distinguish herself from Simon by suggesting she's running a campaign that will limit corporate influence in elections. She points to a recent vote against a bill that would allow lobbyists to buy food and beverages for lawmakers if every member of the legislature is invited to the event. Simon voted for the bill.
Citizens United really does threaten to drown out the voice of regular people in elections, and I was one of only 16 House Democrats who voted no this year to let a corporation spend unlimited amounts of money to throw parties for legislators and their staff, and as Secretary of State, I'll do everything possible to challenge corporations' role and special interests in our elections.
Simon says he didn't support the individual measure, but voted for the bill because it was part of a larger campaign and elections bill. He also said he's the only candidate who has not accepted PAC or lobbyist donations as a lawmaker. Kalin says he's running because he wants to continue Richie's work in the Secretary of State's office. Kalin, who now lives in Minneapolis but represented Lindstrom when he was elected to the House in 2006 and 2008, says he has the perspective to keep every Minnesota voter in mind.
I know the different places, the different kinds of atmospheres and conditions that our election systems are run, from the very most rural, where a township election has as little as 30 or 40 votes, to urban central Minneapolis locations where people stand in line till 10 o'clock at night.
While Simon, Kalin, and Hillstrom are actively courting DFL support, no Republican has filed the paperwork to run for the seat. But Minnesota Republican Party Chair Keith Downey isn't too worried about it after another Democrat, former Hennepin County Elections Manager Rachel Bowman, dropped out of the race late last week.
The first person to jump in jumped back out, so I'm not sure that the Democratic field is that much more stable or committed. I think those constitutional offices, in contrast to the U.S. Senate race and the governor's race, really don't start taking shape until this fall or even, you know, early next year in 2014.
Downey insists that Republicans will put forward a solid candidate. And even though the three Democrats running in the race praised Mark Richey for his work, Downey characterized him as a highly partisan Secretary of State. It's a charge Republicans have made for years, especially during the hotly contested U.S. Senate recount in 2008.
Tom Scheck at the State Capitol and on the NPR News Update. After providing school districts with a lot of money this year, DFL Governor Mark Dayton is now telling school leaders he wants to ease the financial burden caused by laws telling districts what to do. Dayton told a conference of superintendents yesterday his first target is a teacher evaluation program set to begin statewide in 2014. Tim Pugmire has our report.
Dayton said the 2011 legislature, which was controlled by Republicans, imposed a terrible unfunded mandate on school districts when it created a new system for evaluating the classroom performance of teachers. Under the law he signed, the system must be up and running next fall. Districts will have to pick up the costs, which could total as high as $200 million. Dayton told superintendents that he wants the DFL-controlled legislature to revisit that issue next session.
It's not my intention to impose that additional cost on you. I did not urge raising the per pupil formula in order to siphon that money off for testing. Although we all agree assessment is important, we're going to do it. It's the law. We're going to do it the best way we can. But the legislature has to face up to their responsibility.
Dayton also questioned the reliability of the assessments because about a third will be based on student test scores. But Republican Senator Sean Nenow of Cambridge said he believes teacher performance must be linked to how well their students are doing. As for the cost of such assessments, Nenow wondered why school districts would have to start from scratch.
The school district wasn't doing it before. They weren't doing what they needed to do to guarantee that we had a quality teacher educating children. So to that end, I guess you could say it might be an additional cost for some schools, but it shouldn't be an additional cost because they should have been doing something along this line in the first place.
Governor Dayton asked the superintendents to help address the teacher evaluation funding issue, as well as two of his long-range education goals. He said he wants to lower Minnesota dropout rates and ensure that all students are reading at or above the proper grade level.
I'm glad we have all-day kindergarten now, state-funded. I'm glad we have increasing availability of early childhood scholarships, but we still know the kids are going to come
to school first, second, and third grade and beyond from other other states, from even other countries. So we need a way that we can approve. We need best practices ways in which we can take those children and over the course of a school year, give them the skills that they need in order to be successful.
Dayton didn't dwell on this year's education bill, but the superintendents who will benefit from the $485 million in new spending were clearly pleased. They welcomed the governor with a prolonged standing ovation.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks. Thank you very much.
North Branch Superintendent Deb Hinton was among those who thanked Dayton for providing a needed funding increase.
My kids have had years and years of budget cuts. When I go back to my district today, I'm going to ask for a list of all the budget cuts that we've made over the past 13 years and start dreaming about what we can add back, and you have helped make that possible. Thank you so much.
Hinton later explained that North Branch will benefit from a new law that allows school districts without an operating referendum to levy up to $300 per student without putting the measure to voters. She said if the school board approves that levy authority, North Branch could end its four-day school week and return to a five-day schedule.
Tim Pugmire for us. Farmer discontent with Congress seems to be growing as quickly as Minnesota's soybean crop. The unhappiness is aimed at lawmakers' inability to pass the central piece of the nation's rural policy, the Farm Bill. Reporter Mark Stile sampled opinion on the issue at the state's premier agricultural show yesterday, FarmFest, and he has this report.
Walk down the streets of FarmFest in southwest Minnesota and you'll see shiny new tractors, grain bins, and other components of modern-day agriculture. Stop a farmer and ask a question about the Farm Bill and you're likely to see another expression of today's agriculture. Usually it's a roll of the eyes, a slight smile, or a shoulder shrug. Southern Minnesota farmer Chad Grosskreutz just gives a slight shake of his head before he talks about the congressional inaction on the Farm Bill.
They know what they need to do. They just refuse to do it for political purposes or grandstanding or whatever it is. We need something in place.
Ask him how the inaction affects his farm, and he's got an answer. He points to conservation steps he's taken. Grosskreutz has installed grass strips along some of his drainage ditches to slow erosion. The grassy areas trap soil particles before they wash into the ditch and eventually downstream into rivers. Federal programs help pay part of the installation cost. He'd like to put in more grass strips, but he's holding off because he's not sure if the next Farm Bill will have money to help farmers offset the expense.
Those programs aren't there. You can't keep on with that stuff.
Grosskreutz is diplomatic. He just says he hopes Congress will act. Other farmers were not so nice, although they declined an interview request. One called federal lawmakers a bunch of clowns, and another said Congress is putting party principles above the good of the nation. Banker Doug Legault says the lending industry is also closely watching Farm Bill developments. He works for Mankato-based United Prairie Bank. The bank loans nearly $300 million a year to farmers and other agricultural businesses. Legault says the federal Farm Bill is an important tool in helping to stabilize farm finances. He says the government role is needed because farmers have little control over how much they're paid for their work.
It's the only industry that I know of that doesn't set its own price. You go to buy a pair of shoes or something at a store and you walk in and the price is this for those pair of shoes. There's not a lot of negotiation, but when you grow a crop or you have livestock, you take it to the elevator, to the sale barn, to the packer. They set the price.
Farm income has been strong the past several years, mainly because of high grain prices. But those prices are falling now, and farmers say that demonstrates the economic uncertainties the Farm Bill helps them cope with. But so far, there's no sign Congress will act. At a FarmFest issues forum on the situation, Windham area farmer Andy Olson voiced the frustration he said many farmers feel.
I'm sure everyone here is asking the question, how could we get so screwed up in this country? It's become so acrimonious and hostile, and it seems like people can't agree.
It was a question no one had an answer to, even those in the middle of the battle to pass a new Farm Bill. Minnesota Congressman Colin Peterson, the ranking Democrat on the House Ag Committee, said Congress has many hurdles to cross before it gets close to passing farm legislation. One of the biggest issues is what, if any, cuts should be made in the food stamp program, which traditionally has been part of the Farm Bill.
So the question is, when are we going to get this done, or are we going to get this done? My honest answer is I don't know.
Congress also deadlocked a year ago on the farm bill, eventually passing a one-year extension of the 2008 farm program. Peterson says another extension is a likely path again this year for the stalled Congress.
Mark Style there in Redwood Falls. The Minnesota Vikings are getting ready to kick off their last season in the Metrodome. And Tim Nelson says that has some Metrodome goers already feeling a little wistful about the coming end of the stadium that everyone loves to hate.
That's the sound of the beginning of the end on Mall of America Field. It's Wayne Enger starting up his paint sprayer in the eastern end zone, about to add the white border to the giant V-I-K-I-N-G-S already painted in purple on the turf. Only two preseason home games and seven regular season games remain. Fleeting as it may be, the maintenance staff still wants the field to look its best. Leo Pitti is the manager of building services for the Metrodome.
They are the straightest lines in the NFL. We've been here a long time, the people, very experienced staff.
He credits Enger, whose steady hand guides a paint nozzle about 8 inches above the ground, laying down a stripe of white paint on the fake grass and ground-up rubber that covers the Vikings' home field. It's already been painted with yard markers, sidelines, and hash marks. Enger says it takes gallons and gallons of paint.
For everything, logos, sidelines, and everything, probably over 40. That's just a quick guess.
Another painter, Ken Janisch, says he's sprayed the signature Viking portrait at midfield maybe 100 times in the 15 years or so he's worked at the Metrodome. He started the job one more time, waving a yard-long painting wand over the ground. Is it art?
There's a little bit of talent, but I call it paint by numbers. All right, you put out your blocker and then go where the numbers go.
And even that may not be long for pro football in Minnesota. The Vikings will be moving to TCF Bank Stadium next summer for two seasons on the U of M campus. Then they'll play in the new $975 million publicly funded stadium in downtown Minneapolis starting in 2016. Stadium officials say they're weighing removable specialty turf for that new stadium. The yard lines, sidelines, and logos would be inlaid into the fabric itself without the need to add markings for the NFL. Michelle Kelm-Helgen is the chairwoman of the Minnesota Sports Facilities Authority, the agency that runs the Metrodome and is building its replacement.
We look at this, the inlaid turf, then when you go to soccer or baseball, you know, some of these other sports, you actually need a second turf. So one of the things we've been looking at is if we actually purchase two turfs to start with, would that give us, you know, essentially an extended life on both turfs?
Which isn't to say fans and stadium officials don't have some fond feeling for the field where the Vikings and Twins started playing in 1982. Mileposts are already slipping by, like the last baseball game ever played in the Dome on July 2nd. Requests are already coming in for keepsakes, like pieces of turf when the stadium comes down.
There's always melancholy looking at the Dome coming down, especially. I think when we get to that point at the end of the Viking season in February, hopefully if they make the playoffs, that people will certainly feel a lot of melancholy as the actual building comes down.
The last game the Vikings could possibly play in the Metrodome is scheduled now for January 19th, an NFC Championship game. That's a long shot by any measure. Kelm-Helgen says crews will start dismantling, then demolishing the Metrodome about 6 weeks after the clock runs out on the last Vikings game, about 5 months from now.
Tim Nelson in Minneapolis. Arts guy Ewan Kerr finishes off the NPR News Update today. In the comic books world, there are Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, and Love and Rockets. Some hardcore comics fans consider it the pinnacle of the art form. As Ewan reports, a new show at the Minneapolis College of Art and Design allows visitors to get a close-up view of the work of one of the artists behind the comic book, Jaime Hernandez.
For 30 years, Love and Rockets has followed the lives of a ragtag group of friends living just outside Los Angeles.
You know, his main character, his name is Maggie. Her best friend is called Hopi.
But cartoonist Zach Sally, who teaches comic book art at MCAD, says Maggie and Hopi are just the beginning. There are dozens of characters. Sally organized the Jaime Hernandez show. He says Love and Rockets grew out of the do-it-yourself ethos of the L.A. punk rock scene of the 1970s. Hernandez didn't draw superheroes. He wrote about and drew people living real lives.
Like actual human beings who, over the course of 30 years, he's explored their lives and how they work and how they intersect and just kind of what their lives are made of.
There are occasional incidents of magical realism, but more in the vein of Gabriel Garcia Marquez than Harry Potter. Sally describes himself as a comic books fan, and he says it doesn't get any better than in Love and Rockets.
I've been checking in with these characters every 4 months since I was 16 years old.
And that was a long time ago.
We don't want the 16 inches here, but it's like part of the same grouping that will set it off a little bit.
Oh, okay.
Sally and MCAD gallery manager Carrie Morgan set about hanging the original Hernandez artwork, handling the pages with reverence. The images, hand-drawn in black ink, are crisp and pristine. Hernandez is so good, he rarely resorts to a staple of all comic book artists, whiteout. Telling a story in a comic is hard. Sally says the words and the pictures have to come together perfectly to tell the tale succinctly, understandably, and in the exact number of panels to fit the page.
People try to relate comics to literature or film or whatever, and it relates to all those things, but what it is actually its own language.
Sally says Hernandez is self-taught.
To people who know Jaime's work, they're kind of in awe of it. Nobody has ever done what he's done in comics. As far as I'm concerned, I know my stuff, so.
The main aim was I wanted to draw comics and not get a real job.
Speaking from his home in California, Jaime Hernandez is disarmingly dismissive at times about what he does. Then he'll talk passionately about the challenge of getting a comic right.
The first thing is the words help the pictures and the pictures help the words.
Hernandez doesn't like doing one without the other, and even after 30 years, it's still a struggle.
I guess the easy part is that I understand it more. The hard part is actually, you know, still putting it down and putting it down right.
He says the Love and Rockets characters are often based on real people, or maybe just a feature, like a hairstyle he saw on the street. Maggie started as a generic character he drew as a teenager, but slowly developed into a complex and charismatic individual. Hernandez says he wanted to capture the punk sensibilities of the time and his own Mexican-American culture.
And in 1981, when we started the comic, there just really wasn't that much known about my culture in comics, in TV, in movies, even. If it was handled, it was handled poorly, because it was for people who really didn't know it.
Jaime Hernandez will be in Minneapolis to speak at the MCAD exhibit on August 16th. He'll then be the special guest at Autoptic, a one-day comics festival held at Aria in downtown Minneapolis on August 18th. When asked if he'll be doing Love and Rockets for another 30 years, he says he doesn't know. Then he adds that's only because he can't predict if he'll still have the hand or the eyes to keep doing what he does.
Because I'm not done. These characters have a lot more to do.
All being well, the next edition of Love and Rockets will debut when Hernandez visits Minneapolis.
You and Care closing out the podcast. Glad you listened to the whole thing. I'm Phil Picardi, and I'll be back with Thursday's news on the NPR News Update. Just for you while you drive, exercise, or catch up far away from home, even if you use it as a sleep aid.